The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. We are reading today from the June 2018 edition of Smithsonian. We continue from last week, Taming the Lionfish, an incredible story about an incredible supply of lionfish in Florida. They seem to be taking over, but the good news is they taste good, but they're treating it as sort of an apocalypse. When we left the story last week, the last couple sentences read, "But now we've got to tackle the deep water problem and do regional control. And how do you do that? You've got to engage lots of people and maybe lots of different ways." And now we pick up with the story. I believe the fishing communities, they answer to that. I don't think that conservation people like myself can buy a bunch of ROVs and go down and shoot them and do things. The fisherman who has a good ROV or some other way of catching lionfish might do that, and that's a good thing, because they get to A, kill fish, and B, sell fish and make money, and take the pressure off other species while they're doing it. So that's why I got into the thinking about traps to deal with deep water populations. My logic was, let's design traps that fishermen would be comfortable with, which is mechanical. Fully mechanical, easily deployed, easily retrieved, you can put a bunch of them on a fishing boat. And then we've got to deal with the regulatory matters related to that. In the next tent over, there's a beautiful mermaid in a chaise lounge talking to children about ecology and our collective responsibility to the environment. There's a long line of kids and their dads waiting to speak to her. Around the corner, I talked to Brian Asher, a diver and spearman, and one of the directors of Sea Leg, a nonprofit trying to grow lionfish business into sustainability. As a business problem, we have this incredible supply of lionfish. They're breeding rapidly, and on the other end, you have restaurants and grocery stores. You have this huge demand, and there's really no efficient way of connecting the two right now. The traps, though, haven't been available until the last 2 or 3 months, when NOAA published the plans, and that's an inexpensive, easily deployable trap design. Taking commercial fishing operations and having them focus on this would be, just huge gains can be made out of that. But it's convincing that fishing community, and then, on the flip side of that, convincing the public that, hey, this is something good to eat, and there's still a lot of resistance in the public. Hence all the tastings, and venomous, not poisonous. Right, and right again, we enjoy diving, we enjoy our reefs. The first time I pulled up a lionfish, it had a shovelhead lobster baby in its stomach. It was like, all right, game on. I want to go down and I want to spearfish for my allotment of snapper or grouper. Or I want to pick up spiny lobster. Those little guys are eating what I am, eating my stuff. Well, someone needs to do something to fix that, and it might as well be us. One of the best ways to break through with the public would be to get a big national retailer on board. Guess who's here this weekend with their own tent? Whole Foods Market. Dave Ventura is the grocery chain's Florida Regional Seafood Coordinator. The stores have been rolling out lionfish on a test basis for the past 2 years or so. The response has been overwhelmingly positive. Our customers here in Florida are very well educated about our ecosystem, our environment, are passionate about protecting them. They're very happy to hear that the Whole Foods in Florida has taken the lead on trying to be part of the solution to remove the lionfish from the water. What I can say is we've been selling lionfish for 15 months, and I'm happy to report we've sold over 30,000 pounds. You know, everybody seems to realize that the good news is we scratched the surface. We developed a market. We know there's a market. Now it's like, hey, how do you get it on scale? How do we remove the lionfish in large volume? Once we accomplish that, then I think I can say confidently that we are making a dent, making a difference. Right now, I think we've been very successful in creating public awareness. And Whole Foods is developing its own product lines, too, like smoked lionfish. There are a million ways to prepare it. In fact, do an image search for the whole fried lionfish. It's a centerpiece showstopper at several local restaurants. With the fins fanned, golden brown in all directions, at the end of the meal, they hand out the spines as toothpicks. So we're going to find the rapaciousness of one species with the bottomless appetites of another, ours. Lionfish in this hemisphere have only one enemy, us. But it's going to take some doing, because venomous, not poisonous, sounds like something Truman Capote might have said about Gore Vidal on the Dick Cavett Show. Saturday night, there's a lionfish tasting. This is upstairs at the Bodacious Olive, a restaurant, an evening space on a charming old town stretch of brick storefronts, not far from the park and the tournament tents across from a Pilates studio. The wind howls and low clouds worry the rooftops, but inside the Edison bulbs glow and the wine glasses sparkle, and the test kitchen is as snug and clean as a catalog layout. There are 40 or so of us here, sponsors and spear hunters, and dive masters, wives and husbands, and scientists, captains and mates and mermaids. Celebrity Florabama chief advocate John Gibson is making lionfish tacos and lionfish sashimi and talking about sustainability and lionfish deliciousness. There's Captain Andy, and there's Allie and Brian, and John and Steve. Barry isn't here. He's across town at Pensacola State for a screening of the documentary Reef Assassin, produced by Mark Wappas and edited by Mary Beth Abrams. It's all about the lionfish invasion. But thanks to a scheduling wormhole, these two events are happening at the same time. Some of the people at the movie should be here. Some of the people in the movie are standing right in front of me. Confused, I talk to the mermaid. Her name is Maura Dobbs. She is from Plano, Texas, and she runs a mermaid school. I'm in italics and a business suit. Do you find that the kids retain the things you tell them about lionfish? Absolutely. And what's so great is Coastwatch Alliance not only does amazing things for the lionfish invasion issue, but they also are big into marine debris awareness and cleanup. When I do these in-character performances, if they're a birthday party, if they're an event, I bring balloons, straws, fishing line, different things that I pick up at the bottom of the ocean as a diver and say, "Hey, it was nice to meet you. When I go home, look at all these things that are all over my house." And I watch it wash over these kids, and it's creating little echo warriors. She looks just about exactly how you'd picture a mermaid, pale, pretty, lots of auburn hair. In fact, think of Ariel easing out of her 20s on the way to a job interview, and you'll have it. But out there under the tent on her chaise, sun bright and the bay sparkling, wearing the tail and her magnificent fin, talking to children, the illusion is complete. So how long have you been doing this? Professionally, a couple of years now. I host a full-time professional mermaid school that's actually in landlocked DFW, Texas. Do you get a lot of good turnout in Dallas-Fort Worth? We do, in many walks of life, for mermaid school, and that also allows me to establish a great performance troupe that does the same kind of in-character performances that I do. Birthday parties, ocean education, library readings, stuff like that. Are you a lionfish hunter in your own time? I am, yes. So you know all these guys? Yes, as a mermaid and a diver. I was going to say, do a lot of the dads hit on the mermaid when they bring the kids over? We get the, "Hey," speaking mythologically. I don't know if mermaids wear tops. We call those merverts. But yes, I'm all about the banter. So the tail, that thing I was wearing today, is a free-diving monofin embedded inside 40 pounds of platinum dragon skin silicone. So you can free-dive in the ocean in that thing, hot, though, on land. Yes, it's hot. It's neutrally buoyant and really wonderful to swim in the ocean or pool, but it's a little rough after a few hours. I do dry out. Every 2 or 3 hours, I take a 30-minute break. You need to. Your feet are inside of that really heavy fluke. The fluke is the bottom of the tail that you see. It's kind of like being on point in ballet. So if you could tell America one last thing as the mermaid spokesperson, yes, on behalf of the lionfish invasion awareness, yes, what would you say? Seek, find, and destroy, man. Truth is, lionfish taste pretty great. The raw flesh of the fish is opalescent, a fine-grained and smooth, nearly translucent, with a flavor to match. On the tongue, uncooked, it melts fast and tastes faintly of the sea, a memory of salt rather than salt itself. Baked, broiled, fried, poached, grilled, seared, or blackened, the meat of the fish is firm and white and buttery. It takes and holds whatever flavors you throw at it. Whether you're making ceviche or fish and chips, it stands up to Cajun rub and to citrus and to wasabi and to remoulade and cilantro and garlic and ginger and cumin and aioli. It won't back down from red peppers or green chilies. It's as fearless as the person cooking it. Everyone lines up for samples. Lip-smacking ensues. Don't be afraid of it, John Gibson says low and sweet to us all. This is a versatile fish. He's slicing fillets so thin you could read a newspaper through them. Just remember, the fish is venomous, not poisonous. And out we all go into that windy evening. Sunday. Most of the tents were blown down overnight, so the park looks forlorn as folks work to reset for the big day. There's Captain Andy picking up chairs and tables, while Adele rolls in the deep on the PA. The early crowd is sparse, but by mid-morning, even under threat of rain, the little plaza is filled again, and the music rises with the smoke from the grills, and the waves pound the seawall, and the crowd waiting for lionfish-stuffed jalapeno poppers is as long as the line for the crawfish boil. You hear fragments in the wind from the chefs and the experts and the kids and their parents. They reproduce every 3 or 4 days. These are fantastic. It's really good. Aren't they poisonous? Venomous. Go tell your restaurants you want lionfish. There's not much I won't eat. Early in the afternoon, it's time for the count and the presentations to the winners. Captain Andy handles the microphone, and the afternoon is an inventory of his gratitude and his enthusiasm. He and the crowd are stoked. Biggest fish speared was a little over 17 inches. Our boat, Team Niue, finishes third with 539 lionfish. Full Stringer, a crew from up the road, is second with 859 fish. Team Hang On, the all-women's team, wins going away with 926 lionfish. The crowd roars and many tears are shed. Allie won't stop hugging people for several hours. There's a presentation of plaques and prize money and prizes, many of them quite nice, from dive gear to drones to nights out on the town. But it's pretty clearly pride everyone competes for. Rachel Bowman is the first among equals on the women's team. She is a commercial spearfisher down in the Keys and appears to be the lean, inked, freckled, clear-eyed apex predator for the entire state of Florida. She shoots and sells lionfish every day. I've got about a 40-mile range that I work, from Alligator Reef to American Shoals, and I have my spots. I have secret spots. I have public spots. The commercial fishermen in the Keys have been amazing so far at sharing their numbers with me, especially the commercial lobster guys. They know where there's big piles of rubble that other people don't know about because their traps get smacked on them. They really appreciate what I'm doing, and they help me out as much as possible. I like to think that the Whole Foods thing has made them more money because now the lionfish in their traps, they're not worth $2 a pound anymore. Now they're worth $6. You're fighting them to a draw down there. Yeah, I've got commercial trap guys that tell me that last year the lionfish numbers kind of stopped going up, and this year they've actually gone down a little bit. I know Dr. Stephanie Green with Oregon State University has been doing some research with the organization Reef. They found on isolated coral heads in the Bahamas that not only is there a decline in the lionfish population, but there's actually a resurgence of the native fish populations. What we're doing, we're never going to get rid of them, but I have to believe we're making a difference. She and I measured fish today, and the whole table was covered in egg sacs. Those are egg sacs that are never going to have a chance to do any kind of damage. What do you think of Doc Gittings' traps? Well, I've got a brother-in-law who's a commercial lobster trapper. And this year, in 3 months, he pulled up 6,000 pounds of lionfish in his lobster traps. That's in Sandy Bottom, 200 to 300 feet, where divers can't go. So maybe if he was allowed to deploy those traps when lobster season is closed, then that's another possibility. Rachel Bowman has a diver down flag enameled on her big toenail. She is the real reef assassin. Grayson Shepherd is the Panhandle charter captain who masterminded the women's team. Like Captain Andy, it is impossible to judge his age. He is sun-red and fit and raw-boned and could be 35 or 235. He is now the red hourback of lionfish, and we sat for a while to talk in the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission motorhome. I put together this little dream team that are just hardcore and fun to hang out with, and they are dedicated and are killers of the deep. They went with me in 4-foot seas the past 2 days, where a lot of men would not have gone. Several of my fellow charter captains canceled trips, and they were freaking out. I'm like, I'm going. The girls are like, go, go, go. My buddies were on the radio like, are you okay? Are you all right? I'm like, man, we're fine. We're kicking out here. I explained to Captain Shepherd about the throwing up. Well, they didn't throw up. The girls suited up and went down over and over and over again. Captain Shepherd is himself a little bit of a sentimental guy. This crazy little lionfish has brought together so many incredibly cool people. We all have the same screw loose in our head. That same screw makes you an interesting, easygoing kind of person. It's a little community. We all have this common obsession with lionfish. You could put all of us in a van and drive us across the country. We would get along like peas and carrots. We're best friends. When you meet us, we're all like the same tribe. It gives us the chills. Even with most teams canceling their Saturday fishing, the tournament still brought in nearly 4,000 lionfish. Turns out the only thing more rapacious on earth than a lionfish is you and me. So I ask folks as they leave, you think eating them might be able to help stop the invasion? And they'll say, it's fantastic, I hope it helps. Or, fingers crossed. Or, it ain't gonna hurt. It's gonna help a little bit, I guess, but I don't know. There's a big gulf out there. That's all they can do to try and stop it. I don't see how that's going to stop it. For the last hour or two of the afternoon, everyone puts their feet up. After 3 days of work and worry and nausea, 6-foot surf and 100-foot bounces, there's finally time to sit around the tents and trailers and drink spiced rum and tell some lies. This everybody does with great relief. Music plays and wind eases, and the bay is a luminous green. Andy says, I think it went well. We had some tough obstacles, and I was a little bit nervous that maybe we wouldn't have the best turnout. And you know, under the circumstances, with the tough weather and all, I think we did a fantastic job. And everybody really came together. And they went out and worked real hard at getting their fish. They came in, and they were all very supportive, and they all had an awesome time, and I think everything went very smoothly. I think it came out fantastic. I've been on the water long enough to know that you cannot predict the weather, and even when you do, you're wrong. Allie is still hugging people. Let's go eat, Andy says. The big finish. So, quiet and tired, everyone caravans to the Saki Cafe, a sushi place a couple of neighborhoods over, eating what they speared. Now set out on two long tables full of hand rolls and sashimi, chopsticks and wasabi, and cold beer. The kitchen bustles, but the place isn't crowded. It's early yet, even for Sunday dinner in Pensacola. At the head of the longest table, Andy's wearing that enigmatic smile, that sidewalk Andy smile. But Barry is the one who stands to speak. He thanks everyone for their hard work and for their excellent spearfishing skills, and for fighting this good fight. He thanks the event sponsors for their contributions and the restaurant for making dinner. He talks about what all this means to the environment and to Florida and to him. When he talks about the camaraderie of the divers and the friendship and, yes, the love, he surprises himself by choking up. He gathers himself and goes on just a little bit longer. "You gotta eat 'em to beat 'em," he says at the end, and everyone applauds. Dolly back, roll credits, that's the last scene in your Hollywood movie. But if you're writing a magazine story, maybe you don't end it there. Not like that. Not with sushi and a speech, too upbeat, too certain. Nor can your story end with the unremarkable wind steady off the bay. Not with the striking of the tents and boxing of the leftover brochures. Not with the loading of the vans or the vendors rolling up their banners and emptying their grills. And not with the stragglers wandering back to the parking lot under a Sunday sky as flat and gray as gunmetal. What you want is something to remember them all, a way to think of Florida and that crazy light, and that water, and those men and those women and those fish. So maybe you'll look back, no matter where you go or what you do, and see them all forever at the dock that Friday night. The whole wrung-out, laughing, groaning boatload, Andy and Allie, Barry and John and Carl and Alex, and those scientists gathered around those big boxes of fish, those big coolers filled with ice and fins and Japanese fans, the sun faltering in the west, tangled in the trees, shadows long on the ground, and the sky, a low flame up there in the spreaders and the shrouds. One of the marine biologists leans down into the cooler and gingerly plucks up another lionfish. "I've got you now," she says to herself. For a second, you don't know if she means one fish or the whole species. And anyway, you can barely hear her voice, because Andy's got the stereo cranked up on the boat and Van Halen is playing Hot for Teacher. It's all a trick of the light, sure, too sentimental and too droll, but it's also true, and that's the beauty of it. It's a long fight. And maybe the lionfish win. Maybe that's your ending. And that was Taming the Lionfish by Jeff MacGregor. This was a continuation of that article from last week. And like all of our readings for Smithsonian, you can go to our website and hear previous ones. So you might want to listen to last week again if you didn't hear it. The website is www.trianglereadingservice.org. Then click on Podcasts, look for Smithsonian, and click on Smithsonian. And then the most recent file will be this reading I just finished. And the next file will be last week's reading of Taming the Lionfish. Here is an almost one-page sidebar titled, "Please Pass the Invasive. If you can't beat 'em, eat 'em," is the rallying cry of chefs in a growing movement to consume non-native species, by Daniel Fernandez. Just about every week, Kamar Durfield, chef de cuisine at the Four Seasons Lanai, receives a shipment of venison butchered from Axis deer, the white-spotted ungulates imported in the 19th century by King Kamehameha V, have no natural predators in Hawaii, and number more than 10,000 on Lanai alone, ravaging crops and pastureland. Durfield transformed the cuts into everything from pastrami to burgers to steaks. It's a better venison, a unique meat that most people can't even get a hold of. The diminutive European green crab has an outsized appetite and threatens clam, mussel, and oyster fisheries across the Northeast. Evan Millett, chef at the Black Trumpet Bistro in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, first used the crabs, which sport tough shells and little meat, to enrich seafood stocks. But he also likes them fried. "It's like eating crab popcorn," he says. Fried crabs float in his signature bisque, which features invasive garlic mustard and three types of seaweed. Introduced to Florida in the 16th century by the Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto, wild boar now roam across Texas, with some 2 million causing $52 million in damage to farms, ranches, and other property. Lone Star native Tim Love grew up hunting the beast and serves it at his Fort Worth restaurant, Lonesome Dove. At first, he drenched his boar ribs in barbecue sauce to hide the gaminess, but diners have warmed to his more untamed approach. They're happier tasting those different nuances, he says. Philippe Parola, a chef and food entrepreneur based in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, has served up alligator, lionfish, bullfrog, and even nutria. A leader of the edible invasives movement, he's now focused on several kinds of Asian carp, intentionally brought to the U.S. decades ago and now threatening to crowd out aquatic wildlife in 45 states. Parola's answer? A prepared fish cake branded Silver Fin, marketed to restaurants, institutions, and consumers. Eating the problem is a great solution. When Sunny Savage moved to Hawaii 9 years ago, she couldn't avoid what local people call halekoa, foreign acacia, their term for white lead tree. An avid forager, Savage found that the fast-growing shrub originally from Mexico and Belize wasn't choking habitats just in Hawaii. It had invaded more than 120 countries worldwide. Savage uses its seeds in tempa, a tofu-like soy product, and in salads, turning a likability into an asset. Acacia is one of 5 invasives on her food truck's menu. Expectations weren't high the first time Douglas Bernstein and his staff gathered to sample silver carp, one of the Asian species ravaging U.S. waterways. I didn't think it was going to taste as good as it did, says the executive chef of fish in Sausalito, California. Customers of the seafood restaurant didn't initially embrace the infamous freshwater scourge, but Bernstein's crispy fish and chips, grilled tacos, and steamed fillets have become so popular he had to find a new supplier to meet demand. And one more sidebar called Grillin' and Chillin'. At Pensacola's annual Lionfish World Championship Food Fest, chefs take up the sustainability challenge. With pictures of tournament catch labeled by Spear Hunter, deboned lionfish, nuggets battered before frying, chowing down on lionfish burger, filet with cabbage, slaw, and aioli, celebrity chef Irv Miller flips burgers, the invasive turns out to be not only tasty, but exceptionally nutritious as well, higher in heart-healthy omega-3 fatty acids and lower in heavy metals and mercury than your standard restaurant fish dish, including tuna, snapper, mahi-mahi, and grouper. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. Address any comments or questions to us at 919-832-5138.